Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
What was the winner?
I don't remember. You just will have to listen to our interview with Tom Hopper, yeah. I guess.
This has all been an ad for Fathoms Deep.
An ad for Fathoms Deep / Tom Hopper.
Hello, everyone. And welcome to Monster Donut, a literary and historical deep dive into the Percy Jackson series and all of its following spin-offs. I'm Phoebe, a dramaturg and story consultant.
And I'm Emily, a classic scholar-ish.
And we are back with Daphne Olive, post-finale and post-season 2 announcement. Hello, Daphne. Congratulations.
Hey, thank you. We are very, very happy.
We are very, very happy.
I know.
There. That's what I love. We can all be happy together. Yeah. It's wonderful.
I can only imagine all the ways you all are going to do some very cool things with Sea of Monsters, so I am very excited.
Thank you for continuing to make this show that we love very much.
It is my pleasure. I love it. I'm very, very lucky that I get to keep doing this.
So, last time we talked through episodes 1 through 5, this time we can talk the whole season, because I mean, the things you're doing in the second half of the season, I can't get over it. I can't wait to rewatch the season in full now that we have it all. I can't wait to watch it like a binge watcher. I've never been one of those, but I'm excited to watch it like that.
Yeah, I do think binge watching the show hits a bit different, because when you get it all together, you can really feel like the way the story works. And like the forward momentum of the story, I feel like it's just really like you really see all the pieces and the dots all connecting and like stacking up on each other that way.
Yay. Yeah, I love to binge in a rewatch. Like I love in a first watch when I can manage it to not do that. And then the binge rewatch is fun that way.
Yes, I'm exactly the same.
So do you want to start, Phoebe, with...
Yeah, so we just, thinking back on the season, came up with like a whole bunch of topics that we're interested in covering. A lot of them are mostly just characters. I feel like the easy place to start is probably Percy. I have to say, and I think you probably already know this, that how exactly to bring Percy to the screen when he is so in his own head in the books was something that I thought a lot about before the show came out. Because there's a lot going on with that kid. He's messy. He's a little complicated. And I really appreciate just how much of that is making it to the screen. And I think part of that is obviously Walker blowing me away every time.
A huge part of it is Walker. I haven't worked on a lot of television shows, but I think there are few people who are as lucky as we have been with him as the lead. It's really incredible.
He is truly stunning. He it's mind-blowing every time. But I think it's also that the journey that you've taken Percy on in this season. So I kind of just want to talk about the story that you have brought out here, because we get to see him working through a lot of things, through grief, through feeling alone, through trying to understand who he is or of trying to fit. And, you know, none of it is a straight line. It's as complicated as I feel that it should be. And so much of it isn't done by the end of the season either. You know, you've set him up for the next couple seasons really beautifully, I think. And so the question in all of this is kind of just, how did you conceptualize his story going throughout this season? This is more a topic than a question, really.
Sure. No, I mean, I can speak to that. The fact that it feels unfinished is great, because we definitely did all talk about him. Like, there's this thing where you have to kind of keep in mind, right, where he's going to end at the end of the book series / TV series, right? And you have to think about, like, what's the first fifth of that, basically? Like, what's the first stage of that? And it's funny, I was going to make a joke, but not remembering the exact line about the Black Sails episode, which everyone is talking about now, about keeping your eye on two things at one time. I used to be able to quote Black Sails perfectly. Years beyond that. But it's fun to be able to have to think in both of those terms at the same time, like, because you don't want to just get, like, so focused on this one season that you forget where he's going. So you want to, like, embed things that, you know, like when you reread, like, let's say when you're rereading books and you'll see something earlier in the books or earlier in a TV show, and you'll say, oh, that was, you know, foreshadowing of something that you love from the end of this, of that story. And sometimes it is, and sometimes it isn't, because sometimes the author figures that stuff out while they go. But I think I talked about this last time, like, we have this benefit of having the whole book series ready for us. So we could be a little bit intentional about that. Like, if this is where he's going, these are kind of the most important qualities of the fifth book, Percy. We could try to intentionally both look at what his first part of the story is, but, like, with always a mind to, like, what is the deepest truths about him that you would understand after the whole series, and ideally to try to thread those through and make them relevant here. And, you know, we had this whole thing about his humanity, which I think we talked about last time, of just, like, this idea that was felt very resonant to all of us, of this kind of radical humanity, and how that is essential to who he is throughout the series, even when he becomes more and more immersed in the mythological world, and just kind of trying to keep an eye on how that affects him in this season, him and Annabeth in particular, how they learn from each other. You know, this idea that the two of them, each of them embody / are more likely to embrace the side of themselves that the other one doesn't so much. Mm-hmm. And so that is how they learn from each other, which ultimately, whether this is a friendship or a romantic pairing in the future, you know, ideally people bond over the ways that they help each other be a more integrated version of themselves.
This is sort of flashing me back to the conversation that we had at the beginning of our episode 8 deep dive about Percy's perception of himself, because he gives that sort of who I am threat. I'm so curious to see how that idea of who I am develops over the seasons.
Well, right. And it's a season that started with him asserting I'm Sally Jackson's son. Mm-hmm. So it's just like I hadn't really thought about those two parts together until just now. But, like, that it's interesting that show Percy ended up being someone who makes declarations about identity.
Yeah, because I wouldn't exactly call him the most introspective person in the books.
I would posit that not only introspected people are the ones who declare what they are.
That's true. That's it.
Those two things can be linked, not always.
While we're talking about Percy, I have a note here in my notes that's just Theseus? Would love to hear your perspective on what you've said on, I don't think you've said it on our podcast, but on several other podcasts now, about Percy being a Theseus rather than a Perseus.
Oh, okay, great. Well, I mean, the most obvious reason, the reason why, it's funny, the first time I read this book, the first thing I did was, like, I think I probably texted John. I was like, wait, his name is Perseus, but he's the son of Poseidon? Like, that's the most basic level.
Then you watch him fight the Minotaur too.
Right. No, yeah. Of course. Like, he, right. It was just like, this whole thing is just a giant goulash of different myths thrown together. And that's what's so fun about it. But it's not just that. So, like, I have to make the caveat that the version of Theseus that is always most resonant to me is from the book, The King Must Die. There are aspects of that Theseus that feel very much Percy Jackson to me. One is he questions. He is a Theseus. So the book is really interesting because it you could read that whole book believing that the gods are real and that there are supernatural powers. And you could read that whole book and every bit of it feels like it's based in the mundane world. Both things could be totally true at the same time in that book. And it's one of the things I love about it. And that Theseus questions all the time. There's just a huge thing about what it means to be the son of Poseidon. But even bigger, I think, for him is what does it mean to be a leader? It's a book that really has that as its primary question throughout of what is a leader? What does a leader owe to their people? And he, he's Theseus, so he's definitely going to think about glory and such. But the thing that makes me most interested in that Theseus is that his leadership was one of raising other people up. So his the whole thing about when they are bull dancers, this idea that his troop, all of them survived because he actually taught them to work together. That he didn't see himself as above them. The minute they arrived there, that he chose to be one of them, not their king or their prince. There's just all these things just that are hard for me to completely articulate, but just feel really essential to how he weirdly maps with Percy Jackson. I know for a fact that Rick did not ever read that book because I gave it to him as a gift. But we did talk about it. John Steinberg did read that book, and that's just the weirdest coincidence that happened while I was a podcaster that I found out that this book that was so kind of essential to my understanding of heroism and fate and all of this happened to be a book that John also had read. That I felt it was a book that I would bring it up and pretty much no one had ever read it. So it was really weird that finally somebody was like, oh yeah, I totally read that book and it meant a lot to me. Which is not to say that Theseus, had too much influence on this show. It just was this interesting thing for me personally that Theseus felt so aligned for me with kind of what I see as the essential nature of Percy's heroism.
Hmm.
Yeah, that is really interesting because historically Theseus is sort of regarded as I think the third great king of Athens.
Yeah.
And a lot of the old historians tried to figure, it's kind of like people who are like, when did the Garden of Eden happen? Where they're like, let me set a date to this. There are a lot of ancient Greek historians that were like, when did Theseus reign? Although it's also interesting because I'm thinking about it too. I feel like what in the past, though, their conception of what a good leader would be would be pretty different though than I think Mary Renault's take. Is it right? Renault?
Yeah, I think it's Renault, but I don't know for sure. Yeah. Yes. I mean, it's very much her version of him. I've never read her Alexander the Great books and I've always meant to, and I kind of feel like I need to. Yeah.
Oh, I kind of want to. Alexander the Great is one of the most fascinating characters in history to me. He's just, he's the worst, but in a very interesting way.
She's an expert at that, I feel like. That is her happy place. But, it's funny. You asked me before we started what my reading list is and actually in my pile of half-read books because all I do is read for work and not, I don't ever finish books. I used to be such a reader before I became a television writer. Is actually the second book because it's her
the Bull from the Sea.
The Bull from the Sea, which I have read, but not as many times. I haven't read it in a very long time. So I decided I should read that. So, I just felt like to read the second book was going to just kind of get my mind back in a fate place again. Cause I just feel like that's because her Theseus story has such an interesting way of looking at fate.
It's funny, when I think of Theseus, the Theseus parallels in Percy's life, I'm always thinking about, the way that Theseus approaches challenges. And, it's partially that, what you said, but in my head, it's also partially the way that he kind of thinks through things and, twists things on it. Because, most of the monsters or people that he encounters that he has to fight, he kind of thinks his way around them or uses their own tricks against them in fun ways, which that's also very much a Percy thing.
That's interesting. I love that. Yeah.
I also, I mean, we're talking about this mostly in terms of The King Must Die, but my brain is also questioning whether, because Percy has now learned the myths from Sally, wondering if he sees the parallels in his own life to Theseus. Like, would he ever put together that he might be a Theseus, or is he too resistant to thinking of himself in terms of story to do that?
That's funny, right? It's true, right? Because he does talk about himself in terms of other heroes. I don't think he's ever compared himself to Theseus, which is funny.
Even in the natural book, in Battle of the Labyrinth, when you'd think he'd be thinking of Theseus, he's thinking of Daedalus the whole time.
I know, it's so true. All right, well, if I'm on season four, I might have to, like, create some Easter eggs for myself in season four.
They all live in the Luke camp. Luke thinks that he's a Theseus in that book, and he's wrong. It's
so true. Oh, Luke's just, yeah. I just love him, and he's just wrong a lot of the time. It's just so sad.
The answer to this might be no, but I'm curious, since you do have this sort of like Percy as Theseus idea in your head, is there any other parallels between character Greek hero in your head?
That's a good question. I mean, and this one, just to be clear, this one is like just a loose, like, this is how my brain works thing. It's not like I'm like trying to map the story to Theseus or The King Must Die. I guess the answer is no, but like not a hard no. Like with season one, I kind of felt like when things started to feel like they were part of the story, but weren't in the book, but were from Greek. It's like, it wasn't like mapped out. Like, oh, I want to draw from this. I want to draw from this. Like usually what happened was that we would have conversations in the room and it felt like this is where the emotional story was going. And then I would go and like look for stuff. So like a big example that we talked about before was like the whole, you know, the Hephaestus and Ares stuff. Like just like it just started to feel so relevant to me, like that their stories were stories that could be reinterpreted as siblings who are competitive because they don't get enough recognition from their parent, right? So like, so it's really, it's less like that I have like matches like that in my head so much as like where the story takes me. I start like mining mythology and other stuff to augment what we think is happening in the Percy Jackson story.
I think that's the fun thing with Greek mythology is there's, you can find every shade of humanity in there. So you can kind of like...
Best buffet ever.
Yep. Well, then within the topic of parallels, if we want to switch slightly away from mythology, we'll be back with mythology. I've been thinking a whole lot about, since finishing the season, but also throughout the season, about how strongly you're all leaning into Percy and Luke as foils for each other. I mean, that's something that we really get toward the end of the book series, but I love that it's being laid out so clearly here at the beginning with like the May and Sally parallel and Percy's attitude toward the gods in the first half of the season, and like how many of Percy's lines could so easily come out of Luke's mouth.
Yeah, I mean, it was, I think for all of us, I know I can speak for myself, like it just felt like one, you know, the smart choice, right? Because we do know the end game and it is about, you know, it's a prophecy about two people. And then those are the two. And that they are like, that the whole confusion about the prophecy is the fact that the person everyone assumed was Percy was actually Luke, which is, I think, one of my favorite twists ever, honestly.
It was so good.
I know. And it's just like, and so perfect. I mean, I think I talked about this before, but like, it's just so perfect that this like concept of the quote unquote hero, which is, you know, which is glory speak, right? Like being the hero. And the idea that was not the same as the child, you know, of the big three, because Percy's never tried to be the hero, really, but Luke has. And it's just like, it was just one of those things where it completely surprises you. And also the minute you find it out, you're like, oh, this is both completely surprising. And of course, this makes the most sense in the world. So it's just like, how could this not, I mean, I'm not saying they're the only two important characters, obviously, but you know, within this story that has so many directions and so many interesting characters and so many different conversations about life, family, glory, whatever, the fact that these two are entwined with each other in fate means that they are entwined with each other in story.
Mm-hmm. The way you phrase that too just kind of made me go, wait a minute. Also, because what you just said about how Luke wants to be the hero, I'm just like, wait. Oh, so, but he is in the prophecy.
He is. No, that's the crazy part, is that he dies a tragic death, but he also gets the thing on some level that he wanted most in the world, yeah. Which is part of why it's so beautiful. Like, my favorite stories are ones that are break your heart and are beautiful and satisfying at the same time. And that is an ending that does that. So, you know, I'm, to be perfectly honest, you know, kind of obsessed with that throughout. Like, I'm kind of never not thinking about that. I think anyone who's been in a writer's room with me would agree. I'm never not thinking about the great prophecy and the end. Yeah, it's, I mean, you can't be blinded to the task at hand when you're thinking about that. But some part of my brain is always thinking about that part because it's so beautiful and so satisfying and such good structure. And so, like, the more that we can be aware of that / point at it, the better, as far as I'm concerned, because that'll just make, you know, I love to think both about the book fans who will have, you know, maybe even new experiences of it through the way we're doing it. But also the people who haven't read the books, that they don't know where this is going, but they're just going to start feeling all the feelings about these two, so that when we get there, mm-hmm. hopefully it'll really, you know, mm-hmm. I just want everyone to feel as many interesting feelings about that ending as I do. So that's my goal.
I think another thing that we've talked about a lot is the link between prophecy and fate and choice, and how, in at least in the books, in our interpretation, there's a lot of wiggle room with the prophecies over, like, how exactly they come true. So, like, the fact that Luke is still, like, choosing to be the hero and that is the prophecy is, like, oh, of course he would. Because there's the one short story that you should read. The Diary of Luke Castellan.
I am actually reading it right now.
Oh.
Because, you know, relevance. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. I'll say no more. But that doesn't, don't read more into that than you. But yeah, I am reading it right now. I mean, I feel like that wouldn't be surprising to anyone who knows I'm working on season 2 and I'm reading that story. No, like, that shouldn't be surprising.
Yeah, we've been theorizing a lot about, like, when we think things are going to come up in the show, which obviously I know you can't speak to, but it's been fun to be like, ooh.
we're so early in the process, it's not even hard for me not to speak about them because I can't, I mean, literally don't know them yet. There's, you know, we're in early days of breaking this story of season 2.
One thing I thought was really interesting also was that Luke's sort of speech at the end of episode 8, the main focus of it was on the familial aspect of it, which makes a lot of sense because that's sort of the themes that the show's been building up, like, a ton. But then the other thing that really struck me was how he still talks about the Golden Age. Because mm-hmm. something that we talk about a lot is how Luke has a fixation on the past. And that's sort of also his doom in a way. And I was thinking about it too, just because I feel like we're seeing so much more of the past in the show as well. So I was just, I'm curious how much does it come up, Luke's relationship with the past and all of that, when you're talking about his character?
I can't say that I've ever been in a conversation that talks about it quite the way you just did, which is really a really interesting way to look at him. But the same thing that, you know, I and I think everyone who's been interviewed in any way about the show talks about is, like, we have to be thinking about the interiority of characters other than Percy, right? Because all we had in the first 5 books is his interiority. So the same thing is true about time. So bringing Hermes into episode 6, like, that, yes, that's obviously great. You know, that's a foreshadowing, bringing Luke's story forward, you know, but part of it is, like, all of those other things were happening simultaneously. I mean, not necessarily Hermes in the Lotus Casino, but all of these other stories were happening during the story that we know. And so things that we only learn in later books, when you're doing an adaptation, are true from the first book. They're true all the time. For the character Luke, in whose head we also find ourselves during the show, his past, all of that exists for him, even if we haven't learned it yet in the books this early, or even in the show this early, but it's all true for him. But now to bring this back to this, to your idea that he is a person who is more focused on the past, that's a really interesting way to look at him or people like him. Like, he is a person who is shaped, let's say, by his own past, right? Like, he's, I mean, we all are, but the harder the childhood, the more likely you are to have the past be present in your experience of the world every minute. Like, the easier the childhood, the easier it is also to just, like, move forward. So that feels like it makes a lot of sense for me, for him. Another thing about the Golden Age, I mean, and this is often also a situation with children who have a hard time with their relationships with their parents, but maybe it's very easy to then project that life would be easier with, let's say, a grandparent or someone else's parent, right? Like, this is a thing that happens. And that has always felt to me like part of his feelings about the Golden Age. It's just like, it was a time when there were no demigods, right? Like, because there were no Olympians. So it's easy to project anything onto a time that you know nothing about, or a grandparent who you can just, you can just tell yourself, yeah, I'm sure it'd be better with him than with my not great dad. So I just feel like a lot of that is, it feels very true for people who just really have had such a rough time of it, that it's hard to just to move on. And it's hard to imagine that the world you're in is the best version of what there could be.
The whole thing with the five ages in Hesiod, as well, as I feel like that's sort of the idea of it. Like, oh, well, we're in the worst one, obviously. The farther back you go, the better it gets, obviously, you know.
I think that is just human nature to some extent.
Yeah, I do. Something else that I also thought was really interesting, because you mentioned there's no demigods in the Golden Age, and there's no glory either. It's very explicitly like the glory comes later. That's what was good about, like, I think it was the Bronze Age, the Age of Heroes and stuff. That was what was good about the Age of Heroes. So it's interesting. It was also, I found it really interesting that Luke's like thinking about a past that like doesn't have a place for him and what he actually wants.
Yeah, I mean, I think if there's one thing that defines Luke and is part of his tragic story, is I don't know if he's good at figuring out what he wants. Mm. I think he's very good at figuring out what he wants to be against. I do believe that he does want good things for demigods. Like, I do deeply believe that about him, that he wants to do good for his cohort, but I don't think, that's just my impression of him. It's just like that he's much more defines himself in terms of what he's against than what he is for.
I agree with that. It feels vaguely related to our conversation again about episode 8 when we were talking about how he tries to run away so often, because he gets to he runs to a place, thinks this is where it'll be better, and then it's obviously not what he wants and he runs again.
I mean, I think I also like, I'm very excited someday to be able to think about scenes with him and Thalia, but you know, also my understanding of him has always been like that he thought she was the one who got him, who felt the same way, who understood him in a way that I think no one else could, because I think, I mean, again, a lot of that is probably projection, and you know, that's a whole different discussion that we can have at some point, maybe hopefully if we have a season 3 and all of that. But I just, you know, he just makes me sad. I just want to take care of that poor boy, even though he does awful things. But yeah, it's just, you're right. I mean, and that's what they were doing, right? I mean, that's literally what they did for years, was run away together. But run away.
I think one thing Phoebe and I talked about a lot was that aspect where they're the two As far as like their mortal parents, they have the least stable backgrounds that we're introduced to.
Yeah. I mean, they both had version of brokenhearted mothers.
Yeah.
Different versions of that, but.
Yeah, that also sort of leads me into my Hermes question. Speaking of Luke's parents, because I did want to ask, because I was so curious about at what point in the process you sort of knew you all wanted to bring in Hermes to season one.
That's a really good question. I don't remember. I mean, to be perfectly honest, that was so long ago. I don't know. I don't feel like it was a hard decision. Like, I don't remember a lot of debate around it, but I don't remember exactly how that conversation went either, but it just felt right.
I will say I loved this depiction of Hermes. Just fascinating. Fascinating, man.
I it was just so much fun to see where these actors took these characters. Like, it just... Like, it's one thing, you know, to have these ideas and then, you know, be part of the process of writing them. But it's just like, I don't know if I could have asked for a better Hermes and a better Hades than I, and I love both of those. I'm just like, it's just so amazing to me that it was a delight.
That's so interesting, though, that's sort of, because I feel like the Hermes we see in season one is a very different Hermes to the Hermes we see, especially in Sea of Monsters in book two, but mm-hmm. I think even later. But I also feel like this Hermes matches up a lot more, like way later in Trials of Apollo. We had Apollo talking about Hermes.
Interesting.
Apollo talks about Hermes as being a lot more volatile, mm-hmm. a lot more fickle than the version we see of him through Percy's eyes in the books. So I thought that was really interesting, where I was like, oh, this does kind of...
But I also see shades of this version of Hermes in, like, the later books, Hermes, especially when he's, like, threatening Annabeth and stuff. I was like, I can so see happening with this guy.
Right, and that's just, like... You know, there's a lot of assumptions also. Like, so if you take the story of him and May, right, and you extrapolate that, like, if I was Hermes, I would feel like he loved her enough to be with them when Luke was a baby. So, like, that's a data point, right? You take that data point. Mm-hmm. He took her to camp. Like, just all of these things, like, it's just a lot of book five stuff. But, like, if you take these data points about his choices, not necessarily his depiction, but his choices that you have to, you know, this is the same thing we had to do with Sally. It's just like you take data points and then you have to build a person. I mean, again, not a person, a god, but whatever, a fully fledged character out of the data points you have, which has to include all of the books and the voice and, you know, but also these like choices that even if you hear them third hand or, you know, through a memory or whatever, like they have to be they have to make sense as part of this person. And so I feel like that's kind of my experience of him, is just like a person who's haunted by his choices, but also tries very hard not to look that way.
Mm-hmm. That was part of why I enjoyed him being in the Lotus Casino specifically. So much was that I was like, he is in a way trapped in the same place too, refusing
exactly.
to look.
Exactly. And it just, yeah, it's just like a place where like nobody has memories. So like you can just kind of like, even if you do, you can still kind of like maybe momentarily kind of live in a stasis, a comfortable, you know, a pleasant stasis.
Yeah, which makes a lot of sense considering when Percy comes in and forces him to remember, because he brings up Luke, why he reacts the way he does.
Right. It's just like, can you imagine, you know, I hope to never have to imagine like the guilt of a parent who's ruined their child's life. But which, again, that's kind of all of the gods. But like, mm-hmm. I think that the books show us that like, despite however he talks, like he has a conscience, he cares.
Yeah. And I think Hermes is the one in the books as well that really like has to dwell on it with all of the prophecy stuff because of all of the things we learn in book five about what he knows. So
yeah, that was the thing. So yeah, that's one of my big questions is like, how much did May see and what does he know?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I don't have an answer for that. But I think it's a good question to have in mind.
I also found it interesting because I feel like there is that connection too of Hermes and the underworld. So also that piece of his sort of duty as a god is having to bring everyone down. You know, again, like he mentions, like I bring people down, people that want to, that go in thinking they're about to save their loved ones. And every single time, what happens? So like that kind of, I really enjoyed in that his, he brings that up as like a part of that whole moment as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of my favorite aspects of Hermes is like not the gigantic list of things he's the god of, but like the fact that he is the one that connects worlds that aren't connected. Like he connects the human world and the godly world. He connects the living world and Hades. Like that's, I mean, I think if, you know, even if you didn't know anything else about his story, the fact that he is the god, the only god, I think, whose actual job is to be connected to humans would already put him in a different orientation about his own demigod children.
Yeah.
That being said, though, I do also want to talk about the underworld.
Sure. That's my favorite design. I have like they gave me concept art from Hades because I was just like I was just so enthused the whole time. I was just isn't it beautiful?
Yeah, it's also very very interesting to me because my question is, and this might not be a writing question, so I'm not I don't know.
You're gonna ask me Dan Hanna questions, aren't you? Yeah. I'm not gonna be able to answer them.
Well, there's one part that I know was a writing question, but another part I'm curious about. So I don't know. But so I wanted to ask because in Greek mythology, there's usually two kind of versions of the fields of asphodel that you see. There's the one that's like a field of white ash, which I do see in the show. I see the white ash sort of there. So there's that. But also there's sort of a field of the asphodel flowers, which are sort of like the roadside weed in Greece. But in also in the show, the specific fields of asphodel, which in mythology are like just where people go, just, you know, who haven't been particularly good or particularly evil. In this version, not only are there trees, but specifically the idea of its connection with regret also really intrigued me. Like, there's more to it than just like this is the field where people just go when they're dead. Unless the idea is, like, everybody has regrets, of course. So I was just so curious, like, what went into that decision?
There's so many things that I could, that I actually do remember how they came about. And I feel like each one you're asking me about today are ones I don't. And this is one of the ones I don't. I mean, what I remember more globally about episode 7 is that choosing how to depict this part of the story was very challenging. And fun, but it was challenging because, you know, we're getting almost to the end of the series. So there's like a lot of stuff that we kind of like we had created that needed to start getting wrapped up. Also, there's just a lot of parts of that part of the book that was just like wouldn't have been good episode structure because it was like, and then this, and then this, and then this, and then this, which is not a criticism of the book. That's just didn't want to translate as seamlessly as some of the other portions of the story that became episodes. The design thing that I remember that we really, that was really a big part of the conversations about it early on was this, the idea that Hades had built an inverted version of Olympus.
It's so cool.
It's beautiful.
It was so good. I loved how, to me at least, it felt very like this was here and then he kind of had to just put a rug in the corner and be like, okay, I'm gonna make my own space.
I love that too. I probably listened to some of those conversations about the design of his whatever his sitting room that he created for himself. But there's something kind of wonderful about that, but it goes with the character, I feel like, that, you know, you would see all of this as so grand and imposing, and you're assuming that he is the one who stole the bolt, and that he's trying to, like, he's this big mastermind, and he's like, no, I'm just a dude, like, I'm just a guy trying to enjoy my sitting room, get my helm back. Like, it just felt so appropriate that he would create this, like, comfy space within this grander space that is not really him so much.
Yeah.
It was such a funny shift to me, because in the book, it's like, here's this imposing god, like the first god that Percy thinks actually reads as a god to him.
Yeah.
And then shifting it to, like, from the moment you see him, he's just this speck walking in.
But I feel like the part of the book that we latched onto is, like, there is a point in the book where he's just like, I'm overwhelmed with dead people. I don't need, like, he's just like, he's just a, it's like everyone else is like fighting and thinking about glory and stuff. And like, he just felt like the one god who was like, actually had a day job and had a lot to do.
Yeah.
It's just like, it's like everyone else like has the time to be like petty about stuff. And he's just like, I just have a lot on my mind right now. There's all these dead people. And they're like, that I think is really, I remember us talking about that. Like that he just, it's not just that he doesn't have a place on Olympus and all of this other stuff, all the stuff that people focus on about him, that he would be jealous and angry and feel left out. And it's like, no, I'm just busy. I'm just a little overwhelmed by my job. Mm-hmm. It just felt so right for him, yeah. Like to both invert the expectations of Hades more generally, but also about like in this situation where there's a misunderstanding about who's running this lightning bolt stealing operation.
Yeah, it's like particularly important here because everyone's going to assume that he must be like his family, that he's one of the big three. You know, he's Hades. They robbed him of his spot on Olympus.
Right. I mean, in all of it, it's like, I mean, you know, to get back into the five book thing, it's just like they made a pact and he was the only one who didn't break it.
Mm-hmm.
Zeus demanded his already living children. Like, it's just, sorry.
Yeah.
Big Hades defender here.
Yes.
Understandable.
When I was a dramaturg on Disney's Hercules, the stage adaptation of Hercules, this was a big conversation that we had about Hades, because it was like this I feel like is always the question of like, what does Hades want in all of this? Like, is Hades happy where he is? Why does he do the things that he does? Does he resent his brothers? And the answer for most versions of Hades is, of course he resents his brothers. Of course he wants power. And I just love that Percy Jackson is like, no.
Right. It's so delightful that we have a story about Greek mythology and the Olympians that is like the most ultimately, like the deep down message of all of it is like, power's bad and you shouldn't want it. Which just goes against every other depiction of Greek mythology stuff, really, that I can imagine.
Should we switch gears slightly? Because I do want to talk a little bit about Sea of Monsters, as much as you can talk about Sea of Monsters.
Sure.
Because I have a real soft spot for it.
Me too!
Because to me, it's a real character and relationship builder of a book.
I love Sea of Monsters. I yeah. feel like it is underrated.
Good. Say more. That's because I'm just curious, what are the things that you like about it? You know, just generally character storylines, moments you're partial to.
Okay. Disclaimer, this has nothing to do with what you may or may end up seeing in the show. I am one of multiple writers and not a showrunner. So, you know, I give input into what happens in a season of television. I am not the decider of those things. I love dualities, and Sea of Monsters is full of dualities. I also love, I mean, not to say it's a simple book or a simple story, but I do think that there is some extent to which it has more kind of thematic simplicity than other ones, which allows you to really kind of focus in. I love that it is a very dynamic exploration of how Percy and Annabeth are learning to be friends with each other. Even in the context, I think, of our season one of the television show, which I feel like maybe brought them a little farther in that process than the first book did, but I still think there's a lot of room in from Sea of Monsters to explore that. I love the sirens. I love all of the challenges, honestly. I think they're all really interesting, and I feel like they're all about identity in ways that are really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I think, did we have this conversation about bookended by two cyclops? ellipses. I don't really know how to
Yes, we did have this conversation.
But yes. Yeah. Still not sure. But I think that they, like, again, to speak to duality, like, I just think that that book just really is just a giant exploration of how to take the story from the first book and frame it in dualities. That is always a fun way to look at human nature and story. And
yeah, I feel like I remember us talking about dualities in that book. It's been so long since I've edited episode 2 of our podcast. But I do remember talking about, like, you know, going through the quest process again, but, you know, it's over here with Clarice now, and, like, going through and seeing, you know, Clarice in the Percy role.
Yeah, it's really fun. And I just think it's a beautiful story. And I know, I'm not sure why it's most people's least favorite of the books, but I love it very much.
Yeah, it must be, like, it's not as big story plot driven that it's its own sort of contained thing, but it is when so many things get introduced, like the coffin and the great prophecy and, like, all of this stuff finally is brought up. So
exactly.
Yeah, I feel like it has the disadvantage of being one of the earlier ones without the advantage of being the first one.
that's probably the best way to understand how people rank it lower. That makes a lot of sense.
Like, you just, like, all the big stuff has to happen towards the end. So you're, you know.
Right. Titan's Curse is where the big story really kind of kicks in, I feel like. So that might be, yeah, that aligns with what you're saying, is that the first two books feel like their own contained stories more. And starting with Titan's Curse, it really feels like you're part of this big story.
Yeah.
And Titan's Curse is, like, the tone shift too, and, like, where
things get kicked up a notch a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Right. And, like, this, you know, just suddenly having multiple children of the big three is, you know, is a big deal and all of that stuff. Whereas here, it still feels like it's going to be Percy no matter what. And
I have so many things I'm so excited to see. My joke one to Phoebe is, I can't wait for Cersei's monologue. Don't know what it'll be. Don't know if it'll exist. But if it does, I'm excited.
Yes, I'm in the beautiful space where I can't really speak to any of it because we really are early days.
Oh yeah, that's not a question, or that's just a bit. My other question is, will the Queen Anne's Revenge be making an appearance?
Will the hurdy-gurdy play when we get on the...
You will, yes, you will get some sort of answer when you watch season 2, whenever that's going to be. I don't know. Oh wait, did I tell you last time the Black Sails Easter eggs in season 1?
I think while we weren't recording, but you can put them on the record now.
sorry, as, like, I just like to put Easter eggs for myself in when anyone will agree to do that. so Old Man season 1 has some that are not mine, that are just John Steinberg writing style, but there is one that is mine. Percy Jackson has two. One is Augustus, named after Augustus Featherstone, which is one of my favorite characters in Black Sails. Anyone listening should watch Black Sails. You will also fall in love with Featherstone. And the other, oh no, again, I forgot the name.
I was about to say, we're going to forget the name again, aren't we?
I'm going to forget the name again.
It starts with an M.
Right, Manderley Academy, yes. Which is where young Percy goes in the flashbacks, is named after Billy Bones Manderley.
Now let's analyze that. What does it mean?
It means that I convinced Joe and I convinced both Joe and Andrew to use names that I gave them.
Well, I think what it means is Percy, young Percy, he's at a book character. He's at a, hold on. I should have come up with a better one for this bit. I had a thought.
Do it, Emily. Weave some meaning into random shit. I love it. Please.
Percy, when he's young, when he doesn't understand yet that he's part of a story, is also going to school at a place of a character who doesn't understand yet that he's part of a story that he will be the writer of on the TV show Black Sails. Percy is Billy.
Okay. Actually, Percy is Billy is actually not bad. Like, Percy really is Silver, yeah. But like, Percy is Billy. Early Percy is Billy. I buy it. I like that very much.
I feel like this is a good time for people who have not seen Black Sails to log off. And for us to transition into talking about Black Sails.
Bye, people who haven't watched Black Sails. Watch Black Sails. You really should just watch Black Sails.
It's really good. And then you should listen to Daphne's podcast about it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I have a podcast about it. Fathoms Deep. That is my podcast that I'm doing a very bad job of promoting on other people's podcasts.
Okay. So I feel like my opinions on this are pretty well established and out there. But I'm curious what connections you see between these stories. You've already said in this episode that Percy is a Silver.
Yeah, maybe that's just me where we start. Agreeing with your YouTube video.
Yeah.
Yep. I mean, he isn't a Silver. Wait, is that your question? Why do I think he's a Silver?
Like, I mean, that's sort of the first one.
He'd be saying, Daphne, tell me how correct I was. Tell me I'm YouTube right.
Actually, I want to know how hard you laughed when you saw Phoebe's video essay now that we
Oh my God. I was Okay, first of all, for anyone who hasn't watched Phoebe's video, you should watch it. But also you have to watch it, which I usually just treat YouTube videos as like that are story analysis as podcasts, but you cannot do that because some of the funniest parts of it are stuff that Phoebe just like flashes a sentence on the screen for a second and you have to really pay attention. Secondly, yes, I felt extremely called out in the nicest way, but I did not expect it to be so much about my podcast. That was hilarious. Also, yeah, it was great. I mean, I've showed it to people, which is a little embarrassing because it feels like it's very much about me. So I'm like, okay, I'm not showing this to you because I'm quoted so much. This is because it's really great analysis.
Thank you.
It's awesome. You know, I love it. The reason why the thing that feels most aligned to me in Percy and Silver is that they, like, yes, reluctant hero is a trope, is a archetype, whatever, but these two have a very similar version, I think, of reluctant hero in that they crave belonging but don't that's a type of vulnerability that I think neither of them are comfortable with in the beginning. Mm-hmm. And I think that their need for belonging is what makes them into a leader, but it happens gradually and they're never completely comfortable with it. That last part, I think they deal with very differently.
Yeah.
Which is where Silver and Percy diverge. But I think that they share everything I said up until that point. And it's just how they deal with their discomfort of leadership is the place where they're so different, which is why Percy, I think, gets a happier story and doesn't end up alone at the end of his story. That's the big difference between them. Silver ends up very, very alone.
Does this make Annabeth Flint?
No, Lucas Flint.
Lucas Flint.
Yes, Phoebe is correct on that as well. Lucas, absolutely. That's actually, that parallel is, it feels to me like the much stronger, easier to see parallel because they're both people who have a lot of anger and wants, like some part of them very much wants to do good in the world and some part of them is so angry that it makes them make choices that lead to bad, not good.
Yeah. Thank you.
Not a problem. Happy to come on your podcast to affirm your
But are there connections that are exist in your head that aren't in my video essay or that you're like, actually I would have connected it somewhere else? Or
well, you did listen to my mythology podcast of Fathoms Deep where I did my whole thing about how Silver is a Theseus, which is funny. Yep. And that all just worked out perfectly for me in my own analysis of a thing that John Steinberg didn't remotely intend to do in a conscious way. parallels. I mean, in full disclosure, a funny thing about who I work for/with is that writers' rooms generally have shorthands. People use shorthands and they end up being other stories or whatever. A fun thing about this first season of The Old Man was that me writing with the co-creators and other executive producer of Black Sails, and that being the entirety of the writer's room, was that Black Sails was the best shorthand. Like, we all, we could shorthand, like, everything using Black Sails. This is not the case in the Percy Jackson room, although it does still, it is still a thing with me and John of, like, of sometimes we will talk about characters in the other stories and use Black Tails characters as shorthand because it's just a really, or episodes or moments or whatever. But you do that with all sorts of stories. Like, I think it would be a really interesting study. I mean, writers' rooms are safe, closed spaces for a reason so that people can, like, really dig into their own emotions, so you don't expose stuff that happens in writers' rooms, which is appropriate. But if that was not true, it'd be so interesting to me to learn which stories become shorthand in which writers' rooms.
Yeah.
And it's been fun for me every time, you know, I haven't been doing this for very long and I've not been in many writers' rooms, but, like, when new people come in, to learn the stories that they will reference. And, you know, one of my favorite things is then to watch them, even if I've watched them already. Like, if a writer in the writer's room will reference a story enough time, a movie, TV show's a little harder, but, like, if it's a movie, I will go watch them because I want to understand those other writers better. So a great way to do that, even if it's a movie I've watched many times, is, like, to watch it with that, the way the person was talking about it in mind. It's really fun. But yes, but so Black Sails, not mapping anything to it, but it is a great shorthand.
Yeah.
Because I happen to, you know, be someone who knows it very intimately and work with someone who knows it in a very different way, but also extremely intimately.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. It's funny that, because I that's something I've talked about with my writing group, actually, is how we're all basically just an amalgamation of a few different reference stories in a trench coat.
pretty much
everyone's is different, but everyone, it's funny though, because you'll talk to people and be like, oh, don't you think that this thing I wrote is such a reference to, like, the I'm totally ripping off these three things, and they're like, what are you talking about? I've seen those three things, that's nothing like what you wrote,
right? But it's your experience of it, which is, I think, I don't know if there are better ways to understand a person than to understand their interpretation of a story that you both know well. Okay, well, no, I think I'm going to turn these tables. Now I'm curious, like, what other things stand out for you from season one of Percy Jackson and Black Sails more generally? If there were moments, if there were other things, I'm just curious now. And I'm not asking this as a quiz. Like, it's not a thing like, oh, we seeded all of these things and now I want to see if you all catch them. Like, I'm just curious because, like, after all the things I just said about shorthand, it is also true, or even more true, that writers, like all people, we have the things that occupy our minds, and so they end up coming back. And so I'm curious if there were any that feel connected to you.
Right now, the first thing that's coming to mind is, like, thematic stuff, like storytelling as a theme, just in both. And how you see yourself in relation to a story that you're a part of. I mean, this was a joke that I was making before the show even came out, that, like, anytime the word story came up, I'd be like, ah, Black Sail writer. Black Sails writer spotted. But I mean, specifically, I specifically was thinking about it in, like, the first, I think it's just the first episode where it's just Percy saying over and over, like, I don't need some story to tell me that everything's going to be all right. Like, he's not interested in looking at his life as, like, this is all going to make sense someday. This is a story. And I was like, that is so silver-coated of you.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I feel like writers are very prone to think about the power of story, maybe more than the average person. But that doesn't make it not relevant to the rest of the world.
Yeah, it's something I'm thinking about constantly as a writer.
It's funny. Like, if you take the people who write stories, they're pre-programmed to think stories are powerful, and so they embed that concept in their stories.
Yep. And then they watch the stories that do that and they're like, whoa, that is so powerful.
That said, some people are better at it than others. But yes.
I also feel like Black sales to me, like, there's a lot of work that is like, stories are powerful. And then they kind of, you know, they'll do a normal thing with that. They'll, like, right. do an expected thing with that. And I feel like Black Sails does it in a way that I've never seen done before.
That's what sucked me in.
Yeah.
I also was thinking a lot about Medusa when I was watching all of this, the monstrousness stuff, like, with the shadows and the, like, just what is a monster, I feel like, comes up in both, but in very different ways, but also in very similar ways.
Right. I mean, it's fun because in Black Sails, the idea of a monster is something metaphorical, and in Percy Jackson, it becomes something that you're, it's an actual conversation, which is really fun. Mm-hmm.
And yet.
And still metaphorical because, metaphorical. Right, exactly. Because that is what mythology is for all of us, is a metaphorical way to examine our existence.
Mm-hmm. In relation to Medusa, because she was on my screen, I was also thinking of Max and yeah. her story and how their stories are paralleled in some ways. And yeah, and then it was the sword training. I mean, I feel like you can't have both Luke and Flint on my screen both talking about what they think warfare is and in the same scenario and have me be like, these aren't related. These aren't in conversation with each other at all.
No.
Yeah. Well, I think it was our discussion that got me really thinking about the past, too, because of course, of the Flint and the Silver of it all. Of you have to know somebody's past to know them. Phoebe brought that up, I should say. I should give credit where credit mm-hmm. is due. But, like, I feel like there's just an intimacy to the sword fighting that...
True.
Because the thing with the sword fighting as well is, like, I feel like you're in a dance and you're in a conversation and you can come back to it again and again and again in just, like, a really fun way. Like, even in our book analysis, we kept coming back to this disarming technique that Luke teaches Percy and how that's used throughout the series.
But the idea of disarming is such an interesting thing because it's something that is a battle tactic, but also something we talk about people doing to each other, right? Like that you disarm someone. And just as a Black Sails thing, like when Anne has her knife to Max's throat and then Max kisses her and Anne drops the knife, like that's one of my favorite dual purpose disarming moments where it is a literal disarming and also a emotional disarming. Maybe we could say that this is one of those things that occupies John's brain, whether he thinks about it consciously or not.
Uh-huh.
But I was not part of that decision for episode 8. So I can't speak to the process of that. I know that John did a little bit in his episode with you. I got to experience that as a surprise, too, when I read the script. Where I was just like, look at that.
What was that look like to open that suddenly. Script and see that?
I mean, it's funny. Like, everything's fun for me in this process because, you know, anytime anything that, like, I had any thoughts that feel like they contributed to something really cool is just like, that's so fun. So like, I have that throughout the season of just like things that just, I know are very important to me about these stories. And that if, you know, even a sliver of them ended up in there, it's really fun. I am still, after all these years, just delighted for anything that feels Black Sails related to show up anywhere. And my very self-centered approach to all of this is that it all just feels like gifts presented to me in exchange for my hard work. I get all these fun things that feel like they're related to my favorite story. So it's just delightful for me. That's a short version of saying that is just an absolute delight all the time. I don't analyze things the way I did as a podcaster because like a big part of how I feel, a big part of what I feel my job is to take whatever ends up in the scripts because I'm not the one who writes them. Sometimes I, you know, am there helping along the way, but to take whatever's the scripts and build from it. Like say, okay, so this is now the story. So like, how can I help take what is, you know, here and turn that into story going forward. So it's like, it's all a gift for me, especially if those things that are now like foundation or kind of something solid, if it's stuff that I love and can really identify with and gets me, you know, just excited about the story, then that just makes my job of trying to figure out how to weave new things from that or build off of it, it's just all the more fun.
Yeah, I mean, I too, watching this, feel like I've been given many gifts. But I described the show to Emily. I remembered Rowan Ellis on Fathoms Deep describing Black Sails as being a show for dramaturgs. But this feels even more like a show for dramaturgs because I've seen the first draft and now I'm getting like all of these changes to it and getting to see the process of like what changes as you sort of go through it and getting to see the story like shift before my eyes, which is just one of many jobs of a dramaturg, is to be a part of that sort of process of watching a story change and to discover different pieces of it as you go.
It's a good gig. Yeah, it just makes me, it makes me so happy. I'm sure that there are people who are not in love with things we did, but I'm happy that there are as many people as there are who seem to feel gratified by much of what we did do. That just makes me so happy. It really does. It's just really my greatest hope was that this would bring people joy and make them think. And
Well, certainly has for me.
Yep, you've succeeded.
Glad. I really am. I'm just so glad. It's just, yeah, it's been a fantastic experience, and I'm excited about starting all over again.
Yeah.
Can you say anything at all about that first writers meeting? Or I'm assuming, no, I mean, no specifics, but like, I don't know, just general vibes.
we worked last week. It's a great group who will probably be introduced at some point. Really fun group. Really great to see Rick and Becky again. It's exciting. It's really fun to be talking about it all again. I kind of missed it, like, even though we had the show and all of this stuff, but I missed like the process of hashing it out and figuring it out. And so we're back there again, which is great.
I can't wait to see what comes out of it.
Me too.
Thank you so much for coming back and sitting down with us, Daphne.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, thank you.
Of course.
It's always a delight. Are we doing a bead for the back half of the season?
Oh.
Oh.
Maybe episode 8.
You all did. I'm assuming you did one already, right?
We did
you all
one
did a
for
bead.
Eight.
So I just have. Okay. So should I do a bead for episode 8?
You can. I suggested 8. If you have one for 7 or 6 that you like better, feel free.
That's very hard. Bead for episode 6. My daughter being a background actor in it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I will take a whistle because that is one of my favorite jokes in the whole series. was where Percy says that that Karen could buy himself a new whistle.
That's a
Walker's
good one.
Delivery of that line was so good.
Walker is brilliant. That kid is amazing on every level imaginable. He's wonderful.
Thank you all for listening to Monster Donut. Thank you, Daphne, for joining us. Next time, yet another special treat, I think.
we're just a regular cookie jar over here, I guess. I don't know.
Which means that you all still have time. Everyone still has time to send in questions for our wrap-up episode.
We're also still doing Trials of Apollo wrap-up, by the way. So if you have Trials of Apollo questions...
Yeah. We're still getting a couple of those, but that's a good reminder. We're still doing that at some point.
Yeah. So if you went back and listened to Trials of Apollo recently and you were like, yeah, I have so many questions.
Or if you watched season 1 and you were like, wow, episode 8 felt very Trials of Apollo coded.
Because it was.
Or just anything in general in season 1 made you think of Trials of Apollo. Or sparked some new questions in your brain. Any of those questions can be sent in to monsterdonutpodcast@gmail.com or sent to us on social media. We are at PJOPod on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. And you can also just leave it as a comment on Spotify. There's a little like Q&A section if you scroll down on this episode.
Mm-hmm.
Also on our social media, we have our link tree, which is where you can find links to our merch shop, as well as our Patreon.
And we also want to send a huge thank you to our patrons.
RK, Window Wells, Emily Ann Bonnie, Roman Consul, Latino Kaya, Patty BCK, Bethany from Public Works, Sydney Fox, Joke, Rina Avila Ramirez Arellano, Charlie McNeil, Bronte Lebo, Chief in Plays, Robert Gamer, Kels, Kari, Leila Hussein, Mason Bowman, Casey Cassidy, Evelyn Zamudio, Kelsey Young, and Busy Cat. Thank you all. You're all wonderful people.
I just keep hearing the Magnus Arcos one. Thank you all. Really appreciate your support.
That was a good impression. But up there, we've got some sneak peeks at some of the art that I've been working on post season one. We've got some of these episodes have been going up early on Patreon too. And we've also got all of the bonus content over there, like our predictions episode, and we're gonna have our spoiler episode, and the reaction videos from season one, and what else? Other random stuff. Thank you to everyone who has already joined us over there, and if you would like to find out more, you can click the link in our link tree.
Also, stay tuned. After we finish our Trials of Apollo wrap-up, we are going to be reading The Sun and the Star, if you want to get started reading ahead for that one.
Yeah.
I still have not read it.
And I will be returning to it.
I am so excited to read it, because I want to listen to that episode of ours. If you have read it and you want to listen to Phoebe's live reaction to it, I can't tell you if it's good or not, but it probably is, knowing Phoebe.
I can tell you it's like the best episode that we've ever done.
Wow. The only one I'm not in.
No, I mean, it's fun. It's just me reacting to the book in real time and then saying my unfiltered thoughts on it at the end. And so this upcoming episode will be me giving real analytical thoughts instead of me just sitting there trying to process what I just read. Okay, that's all.
Thank you all for listening.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.